The following program was recorded live on September 2nd, 2009.
ReachMD XM160 now presents Second Opinion Live with hosts Drs. Matt Bernholtz and Michael Greenberg.
Hey, welcome to Second Opinion Live on ReachMD Radio XM160, the channel for medical professionals. I'm Dr. Michael Greenberg.
And I'm Dr. Matt Bernholtz. This program is a little different from others on ReachMD. There are two hosts.
And we're looking for your feedback right now on the phone, on the web, or on Twitter. Tweet us. We're covering topics across the field of medicine, talking to experts you want to hear from.
4 years after Hurricane Katrina, we're taking an inside look at the extreme conditions, medical decisions, and aftermath of Katrina at a devastated medical center in New Orleans. Dr. Sherry Fink is the author of this essay, published by ProPublica and the New York Times Magazine. She'll join us in a bit. Our number is 888-MD-1-REACH. That's 888-631-7322. Give us a call.
Yeah, we have a surplus of great topics today, Matt. First, we've heard a lot about pay-for-performance for us, the doctors. But should our patients get incentives for holding up their end of the bargain? Some thoughts here coming up in this show.
And we'll also visit the ReachMD Forum to pay our respects to Massachusetts Senator Edward M. Kennedy. He spent more than four decades in the Senate, and health care for all Americans was never far from his mind. Spend a few good minutes with us recognizing the late Senator Kennedy. Our number again, 888-MD-1-REACH.
That's 888-MD-1-REACH. Give us a call. So first, our regular feature, ReachMD's That's News to Me, reviewing curious news headlines from the world of medicine.
Charles Darwin called it an evolutionary artifact, and we've carried the torch for about 150 years, thinking that the appendix was nothing more than trouble. In fact, that quote-unquote worthless sac might be a lot more useful than we thought.
Now, my appendix was a lot of trouble. It was taken out when I was 12. But from the Journal of Evolutionary Biology, researchers report the appendix has been around for at least 80 million years. That's as long as some of my office nurses have been working for me.
Nice.
This suggests that it actually may have a more critical role in human systems, because research published in late 2007 by this team, led by Dr. William Parker at Duke, posits that the appendix serves as a safe house for certain healthy bacteria, as it is isolated from the rest of the gut, and it can aid in digestion and protect against disease.
That's interesting. I mean, we've heard about this, at least rumored among surgical groups for a long time, but now it's starting to become a little bit more than hearsay, I would say. But it's interesting that when we look at people who have appendicitis, you know, anyone who gets an appy, they don't really suffer these ill effects when they get them taken out. So how do we prove that it's useful, per se?
I think it's an interesting question, but, you know, I asked a couple of gastroenterologist friends because I had never heard of this as I was looking stuff up for the show, and they seem to know it. They seem to say, yeah, it holds. It's a reservoir of healthy bacteria. When you get wiped out in an intestinal disease where your bacteria gets wiped out, it can get repopulated from the bacteria held in the appendix.
And I think they're also saying these at this point that there are some studies indicating that it has a role in generating and directing white blood cells. So this clear immune function is going to be an important thing that they factor in when they talk about it.
Okay, so the surgeons who are listening are going to hate us. Keep your appendixes, people. They're helpful. That's what this is saying, I think.
It is the thing that they're saying, but we have to ask the question, is there anything that we can do to limit the number of cases of appendicitis now that we know that it has a more definitive immune function?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Perhaps somebody can call and give it to us. I had no choice when I was 12. It was just doubled over in pain, and next thing I knew, I had stitches or clamps or something at that
point. You're just too sanitary was the problem. And yeah, that is part of the theory. They're saying that there's way too much sanitation going on, and that's what's causing some of this immune dysregulation.
Okay, well, everybody be dirtier and keep your appendixes.
That is
and
the moral.
I think this is a great article. I think there's parts of ourselves that we need to look at and not just go by old thought that this is not a throwaway necessarily.
Now it's your turn. The ReachMD poll wants you to voice your opinion and vote. ReachMD XM160 now presents the ReachMD poll.
In sports, a coach can only do so much to prepare players, but when it's game time, the players have to execute. And that's a pretty close analogy to primary care, I'd have to say. We give advice in therapy, but it's the patient who ultimately executes the plan in a lot of the time. Are incentives needed to foster more patient responsibility? That's the week's question for us. Log on to ReachMD.com and cast your ballot and see what your peers think.
Well, I'm going to take one side of this issue with you, man. I'm going to say, yeah, I think lifestyle changes are important, like in people with diabetes, and incentives work. You know, if you get an allowance, you're going to cut the grass. If you pay people to do something, they're going to do it. So we need people to be personally responsible, and we've all seen it with our patients. If there's no incentive to do anything except like, okay, you'll feel healthier, maybe it's not enough. Maybe they need something like a toaster.
Agreed. A toaster might be an interesting kind of incentive. But we have to also look at the doctor-patient trust. If you're going to add incentives into the picture, we have to almost expect that patients will be less candid about certain habits if they lose those incentives.
Maybe they'll lie, like Steve Feldman, who we interviewed on the show, mm-hmm. said that in his study, patients lied about their medication usage. Well, you know, there's an interesting perspective that we've read this week and also an article on a study. The perspective was from Medicaid in West Virginia, where Medicaid patients, they did an experiment where they had three requirements. They had to take their medications, okay. they had to keep appointments, and they had to stay out of the ER unless it was truly necessary. Don't ask me how they figured that one out. But if they were non-compliant, their benefits would be eliminated or reduced. I don't think that that's fair. It's not good to take their benefits away.
So you think negative reinforcement is ultimately not the way to go about this?
Right. And you can counterpoint that with a study that we have from the New England Journal of Medicine in February of 2009, a randomized trial on smoking cessation. And the rates of abstinence were dramatically higher in a group that was incentivized. They were educated and they were given money because, you know, smoking, I forget the exact number. Here it is in the paper. It's $3,400 a year it costs an employer when patients smoke. So why not offer them half of that to stop smoking?
Okay. But what would be the cutoff bar? I mean, how much incentive is going to do the job and how much is too much? And who gives these incentives?
I don't know. These are things that need to be talked about. But I think part of the key point here is that negative incentives don't work. You don't want to take away people's healthcare benefits because they're not following the rules, because then it's a losing situation. It's a setup for failure. You take away their benefits, then they're going to get even sicker, and we all pay for these sick people. We want to somehow find a positive way to get people to cooperate and be responsible.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out a way in which a positive incentive wouldn't ultimately translate into a negative one for those that don't follow the program, as it were. They stand to lose.
Yep, we need to look at this and look at it carefully, but I think it's something important for the future of healthcare. People need to be responsible.
Well, what's your reaction? Share your thoughts with us on our website, reachmd.com, where you too can vote on the ReachMD poll.
All right, moving on to the ReachMD news quiz.
Here's the deal. We'll examine an issue in the news, break it down, and come up with a question getting to the core of the issue.
You know, I can't tell you how many times I've walked into my own hospital and I've seen staff members, doctors, nurses, administrators, you name it, standing right outside the door smoking. I have to walk through a cloud of smoke. And I'm sure many of our listeners out there, you've seen it too. Personally, I find it disgusting. It sends a horrible message to our patients. We're encouraging to quit smoking when we're out there. And not to mention, it harms our own health.
So today we're going to focus on smoke-free hospital campuses. And one state that may be more of a pace setter for tobacco habits than any other, and you're not going to believe the one that I talk about, it's North Carolina. There's been a movement in the Tar Heel State to increase the number of smoke-free hospital campuses. So today's question is, how many hospital campuses in North Carolina still allow smoking? We'll give you some time to think about it. The answer later in the show.
Okay. And if you're just joining us, put your cigarette out, and you're listening to Second Opinion Live on ReachMD XM160. I'm Dr. Michael Greenberg, alongside with Dr. Matt Bernholtz, both non-smokers.
Both non-smokers. But just do as we do and not, just do as we say and not as we do. Our number here is 888-MD-1-REACH. That's 888-631-7322, MD-1-REACH. That's the number on ReachMD XM160. If you've got something on your mind, do give us a call.
All right. It's been 4 years since Hurricane Katrina made landfall, wreaking havoc along the Gulf Coast in New Orleans. The infamous levees broke, the city descended into floodwaters and chaos.
And as the floodwaters rose, the medical staff at Memorial Medical Center wondered whether help would eventually come to evacuate their patients to safety. But as the days dragged on, with supplies short and no help in sight, the medical team at Memorial faced some truly extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah, and in the end, one doctor and two nurses stood accused of euthanizing four patients. The grand jury in the case chose not to indict them, but much remained unknown about what went on inside the Memorial Medical Center during those days.
So today we're joined by Dr. Sherry Fink, reporter for the independent nonprofit group ProPublica. Over the past 2.5 years, she's been investigating the post-Katrina effects at Memorial Medical Center. Her story can be found on the ProPublica website and is the lead article in the August 30th edition of the New York Times Magazine. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Fink.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome.
So the first question that I have, you yourself, you're an MD, PhD. You've covered medicine from war zones across the world. But what we want to know is how, when, and why did you move into this assignment, per se?
Well, I guess I found out about the story just like most Americans did when it was splashed all over the headlines when a respected doctor and two respected ICU nurses were arrested for alleged mercy killings. And it just was such an intriguing story. And having done aid work in a number of war and disaster areas, I'd never heard of anything like this coming up in my experience. So I really wanted to understand it. And what I realized was that, you know, there was a lot of coverage of the story, but the question of what really happened had never really been answered. So that's what I set out to look at.
I mean, and looking at things in retrospect is, of course, easier than being in the moment. But let's talk just for a minute or two, if you would, for some of our listeners who may not have all the facts, just set the scene for us as to what happened. I mean, Katrina hit, there was a flood. Give us a few lines.
Well, you're absolutely right. We need to cast ourselves back into that moment to understand what these healthcare professionals were, what sort of state they were in and what they were facing when they made the decision to, as two of them have come out and told me, to hasten deaths, to intentionally hasten the deaths of some of their patients. So what had happened was Katrina hit the hospital. This was Memorial Medical Center, I think it was a 327-bed community hospital, very well-respected community hospital in New Orleans, was hit by Katrina, but did fairly well just by the storm. It had some broken windows, water damage, et cetera, but they were on backup power. They were a functioning hospital after this occurred. Although, interestingly, and this is, I think, a problem for many American hospitals that we really need to look at, a lot of times the generator systems are not set up to power air conditioning systems. And this becomes a problem. Even if you don't end up having a catastrophe like in New Orleans, you can get into a lot of trouble with your patients, even just when it's 95 degrees outside and you've got no air conditioning. But getting back to the story, so that it got a bit hot, but things were going fairly well. And then, as we all know, the city started to flood. And so the storm hit early Monday morning of August 29th, 2005. Tuesday morning, the water around the hospital started to rise. And then we had the second vulnerability of American hospitals, I think, which is that a lot of times these backup power systems in hospitals that are in flood areas are sometimes in the basement, or parts of them are in the basement. And that was the case with this hospital. They had a electrical transfer switches were below ground. And not below ground. They were very low, and they were vulnerable to water getting above a certain level. So the hospital executives and their incident command team realized that this meant that they needed to get the hospital closed because they were going to possibly lose their backup generators. So they started.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that right there brings up a really important, almost pillar point here, in that it seems, when you're looking retrospectively at it, that they didn't have much in the way of contingency plans for flooding, for water, which is very strange when we're looking at New Orleans. I mean, they were expecting in all their disaster plans, from what you put down, that they would have roads, that they wouldn't have canals, and that they would have electricity, and that their generators being on the lower floors indicates that they really weren't taking into account flooding. And I just find that fascinating when you're looking at it retrospectively.
Yeah, although, you know, that was in their joint commission hospital plans, which I was able, or disaster plans, excuse me. Joint commission obviously requires hospitals to have these, and they've changed. I think there's a recent set of them that is different from that. They're different now than they were at that time.
Yeah. Can we change tack here for one second?
And, sure.
And I don't want to stop you on your story, but let's get down to the action of the people involved and what actually went on and how hard it is to look back on that and make judgments.
Well, sure. So I think one of the big decisions that they ended up making at that moment was that how they would have to prioritize who would get out first, who would get the slots on evacuation helicopters that would start to come. And so that was another key decision. And they made a decision that the DNR patients would go last. And that ended up having, you know, a ripple effect later, because when they did lose power, those patients didn't do well. And a couple days in, with the chaos of the state and local and federal rescue efforts, there had not been a lot of resources, helicopter air resources, directed toward this hospital, and they weren't able to get patients out very quickly. And some of the very sickest patients who the staff ended up triaging to go last in order were quite sick by the time that their time would have come to be evacuated.
It seems like that really came off as a that particular point, starting with the suggestion about having patients with do not resuscitate orders going last, really had this butterfly flapping its wings phenomenal effect. The way that you phrased it and covered it in your piece, that this really had a momentous effect. What started off as just a simple suggestion and probably was considered an afterthought compared to a lot of the other things that they were having to deal with became one of the most impact-laden decisions that they would have later on.
Yes, it's true. It's true. And I think it also points up another issue with, lots of issues with triage. Well, first of all, I don't know how many of the listeners out there have had to think about doing disaster triage, but that's probably something that all doctors now should really, you know, bone up on. A lot of hospitals, this hospital had, I think, some triage wristbands, and they went to try to find them, and then they didn't have enough, so they made up their own system about who would get the first priority for different evacuation resources. And another thing is just that we don't have good data on how do you predict which of your patients. This hospital had an 80-some bed long-term acute care unit that leased the seventh floor of the hospital. And these were a lot of the patients who died and who were given these drugs that became the focus of so much attention. These were LTAC patients. There's not good data on how you triage patients with chronic illnesses. You know, most triage protocols are made with the thought of a mass casualty incident with a lot of injuries.
Well, let me ask you a question. Let me change tack for one second. Is anything coming out of this in the way of a conversation for physicians about the ethics of behaving in a situation like this and the protections for physicians? Is that what is going on now with Dr. Poe? I understand she's out speaking about things like this.
Yeah, well, that's true. So Dr. Poe, what happened with her is that she was arrested. This is Dr. Anna Poe, a head and neck surgeon, otolaryngologist, I can say, for this audience. She was arrested. A grand jury did not indict her for the four deaths that she was accused of causing. She was arrested on second-degree murder for four patients. And then the story really went away, and then she started becoming a real activist to try to promote across the country disaster liability reform is one of the things that she's campaigned for. Very successfully in Louisiana, got three laws on the books that protect against almost all civil suits for anyone who serves in a disaster. It's sort of like a Good Samaritan law, but for people who draw salaries, people who are employees of a hospital, but get stuck working in the disaster, they would have protections against legal liability for their good faith work. And even some protection against criminal prosecution, because now there's a law in the books in Louisiana, thanks to her, that says that that the DAs are strongly advised, or prosecutors are strongly advised, to put a case before a panel of peers, a medical review panel, have them look at it before any kind of decision about prosecuting a physician or a nurse would be made. So that's one thing that she's campaigned a lot for.
And by the way, is she still practicing?
Oh, yes, she is. She is. She's got her DEA license, everything.
This didn't damage her career.
Well, I think it actually, she's a big hero. A lot of people had a huge amount of sympathy for her, and understandably so, because you look at the failures, the larger failures of preparedness and response when it comes to Katrina, and the person who gets arrested is a doctor who is trying to do her best. You know, there was a lot of outrage in the medical community. So she's got a huge amount of support amongst other physicians, and then even in Louisiana, in New Orleans, it became very, very, her prosecution became extremely unpopular. So I think that a lot of people there feel very positively toward her. She's gotten recognition from her medical school. She was promoted. She was nominated for a national award that has to do with medical ethics. But her version of the narrative, when she's out speaking and promoting these legal protections really skips over the whole question of euthanasia and the question of hastening death. I mean, she basically, in her talks, just goes right from the incredibly heroic and difficult work that the staff did up until Thursday, September 1st, and then suddenly everybody's flying out on helicopters, and there's no mention of these injections.
Should we be talking about that on a national level?
I think we should be talking about what really happened. We should understand that at some point, now she still insists, her version of the story, and she chooses not to talk about the events of Thursday.
Well, what did happen? Can you clarify what happened for our listeners exactly?
Sure, I'd just like to say, in fairness to her, because she's got some civil lawsuits pending, that she has said only that she did inject some patients and that her goal was to treat pain. And what I found was that, I think pain and discomfort or something like that, and anxiety maybe. My research showed why two people stepped forward and told me that they participated also in injecting patients with morphine and midazolam, and that they did it with the intention of hastening death. And so they have come out and explained why it was that they made that choice. And it's a choice that they stand by. They very much feel that it was the right decision, and it was what they would want done for them if they were in a similar circumstance. And so what I also found was that it wasn't just four patients who received these drugs. It was a dozen and a half patients who died with these drugs in their systems. 17 of them were injected when the helicopters finally did come to the hospital, when there was a massive evacuation effort going on, when these people, you know, when it was their time to be first in the triage scenario, because everybody else was getting out. So eventually the DNRs and the Category 3 patients would have been taken out. But at that very moment was when these injections were given.
And all of this must have changed your views, I have to think. I mean, you've seen the accolades, you've seen the public response over time, you've seen the public policies that have changed, but you're in a very unique position after having done the investigative research that you have. I mean, I hate to put you on the hot seat, but what are your personal feelings towards the outcomes and what's happened?
And we're limited on time, I have to tell you.
Okay, sure. Well, I just think that we need to know what happened, and I think that there's a very difference. I'm not a lawyer, obviously. The MD and the PhD are enough, but there's a difference between whether something fits into the definition of a crime or a violation of medical ethics. And then what we do about it is a whole separate question. And when you put yourself back in the context, these were exhausted doctors. Dr. Poe, a surgeon, had slept less than she'd ever slept in her career, she told me. So think about the types of decisions that you would make if you were 100 degrees for, I think it was 3 days at that point, an hour of sleep a night if you're lucky. As some of these doctors explained their decision to me in that they were very afraid. They were afraid for their patients. They heard there was lawlessness. They could hear gunshots going off. They thought, if we leave and leave these dying patients or very sick patients, maybe somebody's going to break in and rape them. I mean, that's
precisely
how one doctor described it.
They didn't leave. They stayed there. They stayed in the hospital. They could have left.
They stayed until all the patients either got out or had died, yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And this story is available at ProPublica.org and in the August 30th edition of the New York Times Magazine. Dr. Sherry Fink, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is a great story that's still four years later, we're still thinking about what happened and how would you react? I don't know.
The piece raises a lot of questions, and I really appreciate that about it. I mean, it's 4 years later, but we have a lot to talk about again.
And we'll keep talking about it. And thank you again, Sherry Fink, for joining us. So, from that, let's get you the answer to the news quiz. As you may recall, we're taking a drive down Tobacco Road, looking at hospital campuses in North Carolina. The question is, how many still allow smoking on the premises?
They've made great progress in North Carolina, Michael. And let's be honest, if they can make progress there, given the influence of Big Tobacco, it probably can be made anywhere. So the answer to today's question is, I'm going to tell you, it's a stunner. Zero. No hospitals in North Carolina allow smoking.
Yay, let's hear it for North Carolina. A group called the North Carolina Prevention Partners has teamed up with North Carolina Hospital Association with a funding grant from Duke to get this done. As of early July, all acute care hospitals have voluntarily passed 100% tobacco-free campus
100%.
Policies. 100%.
Now, you know, if we're going to look at the latest CDC surveys, and admittedly it goes back to 2007, North Carolina has ranked 8th in adult smoking rates at 22.9%. Rounding up the top were Kentucky and West Virginia at 28 and 27% respectively. But if we're looking at the low end, it's not too surprising. Utah comes in at about 11.7, and California rounds up number 2 at 14.3.
Okay, we were going to make fun of California, and then we realized that, well, people just don't smoke as much out there, and they don't need the policy quite as much. But I was going to make fun of them, saying like, "Wow, you guys eat sprouts, but you smoke." So,
well, what is their policy? They have a much more lax policy on smoking at the hospital campuses, don't they, compared to some other places?
Yeah, I don't know. I know my hospital, we have a 100% tobacco-free policy, no smoking, and yet I walk out of the parking lot and there's a wall of smoke that greets me every day. It's really not enforced. That's the next problem. Mm. You can have the policy, but you have to enforce it. My hospital doesn't.
Well, though it is interesting, though, that now that we are looking at more strict policies being put into effect in North Carolina, it's probably going to have a windfall effect for other states. And at least we can look at it and say, well, we're so behind from Europe and Asia and so many other factors, but this at least puts us ahead of the game on smoking.
And now we can do it with food, like our guest David Kessler. My hospital serves garbagey food in the cafeteria to people, and they used to sell cigarettes, actually. So maybe hospitals need to shape up their act because it's important.
That might be a longer time coming, though.
That's
it might
right.
take a little while longer to get on the food train.
Okay, on the ReachMD forum, Matt, where we'll close the show today, we're going to be remembering one of the political giants of our time who we just lost, Senator Ted Kennedy, who died on Tuesday, August 25th, from complications related to a malignant glioma. He was the third longest-serving senator in history, and Matt, I think it's important that we take a few minutes. You know, he's been vilified by some of the my fellow physicians as being the guy who's the enemy, trying to shove healthcare down their throat. But let's talk about some of his accomplishments. You can list some of these for us.
He's had a lot of accomplishments. I mean, when you put it all into perspective, he's been very, very busy. And this is a person who did go on to call healthcare the cause of his life. Earlier in his career, I believe aides recalled him turning down a deal that the President Nixon offered him for universal health care. I think he said at the time that the deal didn't seem generous enough, which I think fascinating. But he's gone on to do all sorts of things. He was recently awarded in December, I think, by the Physicians for Human Rights Organization for outstanding leadership on the right to health. And he's clearly been a part of so many different acts. I mean, you've probably seen all the lists of subcommittee things that he's been part of, all the achievements from legislature.
Well, yeah, he was part of the Women, Infants, and Children's Nutrition Program, WIC. He became a champion of the 1978 Declaration of Alma Ata, which called on the international community and all health and developmental workers to protect and promote the health of all people of the world. That's a pretty big project. Mm. He's also been involved with the Orion White Care Act for AIDS and lots of other...
Yeah, the list goes on and on and on. But, you know, I think we have to put into perspective, you know, what are we going to see come out of the health reform bills now, at least this year, in the wake of his death? Do you think that there's going to be some kind of effort to push a good bill through in his honor? Or do you think there might be like a domino effect by his passing in terms of things are really going to stall? I mean, that's a big question for a lot of
people. I think we'll have to see. I mean, he was really good at getting legislation through the Senate. I think there's enough momentum on this health care bill, and they're going to try and attach his name to it as a memorial. But if we're going to do that, let's really honor the man by getting a really decent health care bill that takes care of everybody, including physicians and providers.
Well, things definitely changed already, didn't they? I mean, because of his virtual disappearance months back. I mean, many think that the healthcare bill that emerged without his guidance was a lot less bipartisan than he might have pushed for himself. Apparently, he was a megaphone to be able to go between the aisles and get support.
And, you know, for all of his youthful exuberance, I have to say, in the end, you can say the man, well, he had tons of money, he had insurance, he didn't care about things, but he really lived down to his last day. He was calling his aides, had his family around, he was joking and laughing. He kind of went, as we said, dancing into death, which is the way it's supposed to be for most of us. He's bigger than life, and he will be missed in our country.
Yeah, he definitely will. Well, I think that's about it for us. That's our show here on Second Opinion Live. I'm Dr. Matt Bernholtz.
And for more about ReachMD on XM160, visit our website at reachmd.com. Feel free to give us a shout on Twitter, online, on Facebook. Call Matt and me personally. We'll answer your calls.
We're around.
I'm Dr. Michael Greenberg. Thank you for joining us this time on ReachMD. And see you back at the next show.